Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 273. It's Monday, September 9th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, let's start up with some good news. This from Stat News. Youth vaping declines in 2024, a public health victory. The number of U.S. kids who are using e-cigarettes has continued to tumble, new federal data show, prompting government health officials to declare an incremental victory in their fight against youth tobacco use. Around 6% of middle and high school students use vapes in 2024, down from 8% last year and a record high of 20% in 2019, according to the survey released last Thursday by the FDA and the CDC. The vape brand Juul fueled this surge, but has since receded in popularity after FDA actions and legal challenges. Public health officials previously struggled to attribute that decline to fewer kids vaping due to the COVID-19 pandemic disrupting data collection. This year, though, the FDA and CDC are celebrating the drop. I want to be unequivocally clear that this continued decline in e-cigarette use among our nation's youth is a monumental public health win, said Brian King, director of FDA's Center for Tobacco Products. The data were collected through the National Youth Tobacco Survey, a questionnaire distributed to middle and high schoolers across the country each year and then analyzed by the FDA and CDC. The survey has asked about e-cigarette use since 2011. King and Deirdre Lawrence Kittner, director of the CDC's Office of Smoking and Health, credited the decline to anti-smoking educational campaigns coordinated by both the agencies. King also noted the FDA's effort to shut down illegal sale of vapes, including a bevy of warning signs sent to shops selling Elf Bars and Esco Bars last year. The most popular e-cigarette brand among kids is Elf Bar, with around 36% of e-cig users listing it as their vape of choice. Outside experts were heartened by the continued decline, but noted that around 1.6 million kids are still vaping. The FDA has struggled to punish both manufacturers and vendors for selling unapproved products, with thousands of illegal e-cigarettes remaining on the market. It is encouraging news that youth e-cigarette use has fallen sharply, Yolanda Richardson, CEO of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, said in a statement. Despite this progress, youth e-cigarette use remains a serious public health problem in the United States. Relevant federal agencies must step up their enforcement efforts to clear the market of all illegal e-cigarettes. So the battle continues. The tobacco industry is a formidable opponent. Okay, well, next up, let's turn worldwide and look to the global public health emergency. This from Associated Press. The first 100,000 doses of mpox vaccine reached Congo. The first batch of mpox vaccine arrived in Congo's capital last Thursday, the country's authorities said, 3 weeks after the World Health Organization declared mpox outbreaks in 12 African countries a global emergency. The 100,000 doses of the mpox vaccine have been donated by the European Union. Another 100,000 were soon to follow. UNICEF is going to be in charge of the vaccination campaign in the most impacted provinces, Congo's health minister told reporters after the delivery of the vaccine, but it remained unclear when the vaccination drive would begin. About 380,000 doses of mpox vaccines have been promised by Western partners, such as the EU and the United States. Dr. Jean Kaseya, head of the Africa CDC, told reporters last week. This is less than 15% of the 3 million doses authorities have said are needed to end the mpox outbreaks in Congo, the epicenter of the global health emergency. And as a reminder, there's outbreaks in 12 African countries, and it's reached several other countries around the world as it probably spread, continue to spread like the first round of mpox, although this one's actually even more infectious. But Congo is the largest and the epicenter. Other experts said it would likely be weeks before any vaccines are administered, given the financial resources and logistical planning needed to get them to where they are needed in a vast country with a limited health infrastructure. What we are witnessing in Africa now is different from the global outbreak in 2022. While that outbreak was overwhelmingly focused on gay and bisexual men, mpox in Africa is now being spread via sexual transmission as well as through close contact with children, pregnant women, and other vulnerable groups. And while most people over 50 were likely vaccinated against smallpox, which may provide some protection against mpox, that is not the case for Africa's mostly young population, who are the most susceptible. And in more infectious disease news, this from Stat News, Gazan children must be vaccinated against measles. We have each worked on childhood vaccination programs in both development and humanitarian emergency settings for more than 40 years. In that time, we have seen a lot. The current situation in Gaza is as bad as it gets. According to all reports, and as is visible on our television screens daily, living conditions are atrocious. The basic necessities of life, food, water, and shelter, are difficult to access, and the health system is essentially non-functional. In addition to the horrific toll that weapons of war have exacted on the population, outbreaks of diseases that are preventable under almost all circumstances are inevitable and, indeed, are occurring. Cases of diarrhea, pneumonia, hepatitis, and other infectious diseases are being reported in large numbers, and one can only guess how many people, children and adults alike, have needlessly died. One case of paralytic poliomyelitis has been confirmed, and hundreds of other children have undoubtedly been infected. In response, the Gaza Ministry of Health, the WHO, UNICEF, UN Relief and Works Agency, and other partners have managed, against all odds and with unparalleled effort, to mount a vaccination campaign targeting more than 600,000 children under 10 years old with two doses of novel oral polio vaccine in two rounds, 4 weeks apart, in an effort to prevent further spread of this crippling disease. They are off to a great start. Demand has been high, and the number of children vaccinated in the first few days has exceeded expectations. Continued success will require attention to countless details: staffing, cold chain equipment, communications, transportation, crowd control, and the many, many other logistical operational needs of a mass vaccination campaign, not to mention contingency plans should any of these go wrong. Despite the high levels of preparations and clear early progress, we are surprised and alarmed that there seems to have been little discussion, at least not publicly, of using this opportunity to vaccinate guys and children against what has long been considered by humanitarian health experts to be the most urgent and most dangerous of the vaccine-preventable diseases in emergency settings, that is measles. Measles has been recognized as a major cause of childhood mortality in conflict areas and other humanitarian settings since the late 70s on the Thai-Cambodia border and the early 1980s in the Horn of Africa. Mass measles vaccination campaigns have long been among the earliest health interventions in emergencies. Measles is one of the most highly transmissible diseases known, with an infectivity rate of almost 100% to non-immune individuals. There are few subclinical cases, and the case fatality rate can be as high as 15% in undernourished children. Contrast this with polio, for which only a small fraction of infected individuals will develop symptoms of paralysis, and only a small proportion of paralytic cases prove fatal. Fortunately, as is the case for polio vaccination, over 95% of Gazan children were reported to have been immunized against measles before the current military assault began in October of last year. But after nearly a year of relentless conflict, a significant cohort of unvaccinated children has accumulated. No cases of measles have been reported yet, but the cooler temperatures on the horizon, the narrow window of opportunity during, quote, humanitarian pauses to access the population to prevent a major outbreak is closing fast and must be seized. Because measles is infectious for up to 4 days before the appearance of a rash it would be too late to mount an effective outbreak response once it begins spreading in the densely populated Gazan population. Since mortality for measles would be high, and since virtually all unimmunized children will be infected, we strongly urge adding measles vaccines to the planned second round of polio vaccination, which will begin in a few weeks. The good news is that a single measles shot is sufficient to counter long-lasting immunity. To confer long-lasting immunity, as opposed to multiple doses needed for polio. A downside of measles vaccine is that it needs to be injected as opposed to swallowed, as is the case for the oral polio vaccine chosen for use. However, now that the operational logistical needs of a mass vaccination campaign are in place, and given the smaller target population for a measles campaign, we would recommend vaccinating children from 6 months to at least 24 months of age. We feel that it would be entirely possible to prevent a potentially lethal outbreak from occurring should measles virus be introduced into Gaza in the coming months. Using oral and injectable vaccines at the same time during campaigns has been standard practice in countless vaccination campaigns, including in conflict settings, for several decades. Starting with Days of Tranquility in El Salvador throughout the 1980s, we propose that this is doable by trained health workers alongside the community volunteers offering the oral polio vaccine. The polio vaccination campaign is clearly warranted, and we should acknowledge those whose Herculean efforts have allowed it to proceed successfully. They have shown us what can be done even in the most difficult of circumstances, but copious evidence from decades of experience in responding to the public health consequences of armed conflict and the unconscionable toll that measles has taken in all affected parts of the world when vaccination has been delayed or neglected teaches us that much more must be done. To forego measles vaccination of the children of Gaza would be a grave missed opportunity, a demonstrated failure to learn from the past, and in our view, ethically questionable. The children of Gaza have suffered enough, and it is incumbent upon the public health authorities of the world to do everything feasible to curb the further occurrence of preventable diseases. And of course, this is all in the context of genocide. So just throw one thing more on top of that over mass starvation, armed conflict, and the spread of diseases of all kinds. And next up, back in the USA, not immune from hunger here either. This from Reuters. Hunger in U.S. continued multi-year rise in 2023, government report says. Hunger reached its highest point in the United States in nearly a decade last year, with 18 million households, or 13.5%, struggling at some point to secure enough food, a new Department of Agriculture report states. Hunger has been on the rise in the country since 2021, after years of decline. U.S. Census Bureau data last year showed a rise in food insecurity after the end of programs that expanded food aid during the COVID-19 pandemic. Anti-hunger group Feeding America found in May that hungry people in the United States were facing a $33 billion shortfall in money to meet their food needs, in part due to higher food prices. The Agriculture Secretary said in a statement that Congress was to blame for failing to pass an expanded child tax credit this year and expanding work requirements for the SNAP program, the nation's largest food aid program. For anyone to go hungry in America is unacceptable. Expanding federal aid and the child tax credit would help address the problem, anti-hunger groups have said. Reducing and eliminating hunger in America will not happen overnight, but the policies necessary to do so are not a mystery, said Eric Mitchell, president of the Alliance to End Hunger. 1 million more households were food insecure in 2023 than in 2022. About 6.8 million of the 18 million households suffering food insecurity experienced very low food security, meaning the diets of one or more household members were disrupted during the year because they could not afford to buy enough food. So that's a key difference. Typically, when people are food insecure, they buy really cheap food. And it's possible to get really cheap calories that are not very nutritious. But here we're talking about a third people who can't even do that. And next up, another story that gets at economic hardship as a social determinant in public health. This is from Kaiser Family Foundation Health News. As record heat sweeps the U.S., some people must choose between food and energy bills. A growing number of Americans struggle with what is known as energy poverty, including the inability to afford utilities to heat or cool a home. Households that spend more than 6% of their income on energy bills are energy poor, some researchers suggest. Energy poverty can increase one's exposure to extreme heat or cold, which raises the risk of developing respiratory issues, heart problems, allergies, kidney disorders, and other health conditions. And the burden falls disproportionately on households in communities of color, which experience it at a rate 60% greater than those in white communities. Public health and environmental experts say that as climate change continues to create extreme weather conditions, more policy efforts are needed to help vulnerable communities, especially during heat waves. Energy poverty is just one example of how climate change can exacerbate existing inequities in our community, said Summer Tonizo, a spokesperson for the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. One in seven households spend about 14% of their income on energy, according to RMI, an energy and sustainability think tank. Nationally, 16% of households are in energy poverty, concluded an analysis co-authored by Noah Kittner, an associate professor of public health at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Old, inefficient buildings and heating systems are prompting people to supplement their energy needs in ways that increase the cost, Kittner said. Pregnant people, people with heart or lung conditions, young children, older adults, and people working or exercising outdoors are most at risk for heat-related health concerns. High temperatures are also correlated with mental health issues, such as suicide and severe depression. Location is another risk factor. For example, in a historically black community in Raleigh known as Method, temperatures can be 10 to 20 degrees hotter than nearby areas with more vegetation and less development, said LaMisha Whittington, an environmental justice and clean energy advocate. Energy poverty is the layering of burdens without a means at the individual level to combat those burdens, said Ashley Ward, director of the Heat Policy Innovation Hub at Duke University. In many parts of the country, extreme heat is a relatively new concern. Policymakers have historically focused on threats from colder temperatures. The federal government's low-income home energy assistance program, established more than four decades ago, has a funding formula that favors cold weather states over those that experience extreme heat, according to research from Georgetown University. Florida, Georgia, Arizona, Texas, and Nevada have the lowest proportional allocations of federal funding, while North Dakota, South Dakota, and Nebraska have the highest. So, as climate change shifts our world, so does energy assistance and energy poverty become more of an issue. Okay, well, next up, let's get to a few environmental stories. This is from Environmental Health Network. Farmers grapple with toxic sludge amid fears of forever chemicals contamination. For decades, American farmers unknowingly spread toxic forever chemicals across millions of acres, only now discovering the long-term health and environmental consequences. Municipal sewage sludge, used as fertilizer, has been found to contain harmful forever chemicals like PFAS, now contaminating farmland across the U.S. Farmers are increasingly concerned about the impact on their health and the safety of their produce, with some already facing legal battles and financial ruin. States like Maine and Michigan are beginning to regulate and test for these chemicals, though comprehensive federal action remains limited. PFAS has been linked to a slew of health issues from cancer to birth defects. And it's not just the soil that's contaminated. Livestock are getting sick, produce is carrying traces of these toxins, and farmers are starting to worry that their own health is at risk. Yes, perhaps we should not pollute where we eat, let alone live. Okay, next up, a little bit of better news. This is from Environmental Health Network. EPA reinstates stricter air pollution rules for industrial facilities. The U.S. EPA has reinstated a policy requiring major polluters to maintain stringent emissions controls, reversing a key Trump-era environmental rollback. The EPA has strengthened the once-in, always-in rule, which mandates continuous pollution controls for facilities emitting toxic substances like arsenic and benzene. Trump's 2020 rollback of the rule allowed facilities to increase emissions, but the new regulation aims to restore stricter standards. While some industrial sources may still downgrade their classification, most will remain subject to tougher emission regulations. And why this matters? Toxic pollutants from industrial plants pose serious health risks, especially to low-income communities near these facilities. Strengthening pollution controls can help reduce cancer and other health problems caused by long-term exposure. So this was most of a rollback of a rollback. So we're almost back to where we were prior to the Trump administration. But up next, we have a story that really gets we need a more wholesale change in our approach to dealing with toxic chemicals. This is from the Environmental Health Network. Outdated and static regulatory approaches hinder public health, scientists say. A new commentary in Frontiers in Toxicology examines how current approaches to testing chemicals need to be updated to better protect human health, particularly in the U.S. In short, the authors emphasize that testing chemicals for toxic effects before they're allowed to be used in products or manufacturing, as well as periodic retesting and reevaluation, is critical for protecting human health. They also point out that many of the testing methods used by U.S. regulators focus on acute and immediate signs of toxicity and don't account for longer-term health outcomes that are more relevant to public health. Key quote from this article, better testing and better use of testing data can protect the public's health. Why all this matters? While the science around the health impacts of chemical exposures has continued to develop, the risk assessment and testing methods that underpin much of the U.S.'s regulations aren't frequently updated. While some regulatory bodies in Europe take a stronger approach to toxics, chemicals that have been linked to diseases by thousands of studies are still used in consumer products worldwide. And another area that I've reported on before, too, is that we generally study single chemicals when, in fact, humans and other living beings in the environment are exposed to 1,000 chemicals simultaneously. Okay, next up, a quick story on abortion, this from Health Affairs. Abortion restrictions threaten miscarriage management in the United States. Miscarriage and abortion require similar clinical management. Restrictions placed on abortion threaten the quality of miscarriage care, a policy spillover that affects many Americans. We estimate that over 1 million miscarriages occur annually, including nearly 400,000 in the U.S. states with abortion bans. Attempts to restrict mifepristone access further threaten miscarriage management. So, a rather huge side effect of abortion restrictions is miscarriage management, since they're treated similarly. Okay, well, American healthcare is heavily dependent on pharmaceuticals, so I want to do a few stories on pharmaceuticals and the pharmaceutical industry. This first one from Kaiser Family Foundation Health News. With TV drug ads, what you see is not necessarily what you get. Drug ads have been ubiquitous on TV since the late 1990s and have spilled out onto the internet and social media. The United States and New Zealand are the only countries that legally allow direct-to-consumer pharmaceutical advertising. Manufacturers in the U.S. have spent more than $1 billion a month in ads in recent years. Last year, three of the top five spenders on TV advertising overall were drug companies. Such promotion was banned until 1997, when the FDA reluctantly allowed pharmaceutical ads on TV, so long as they gave an accurate accounting of a medicine's true benefits and risk, including a list of potential side effects. With those guardrails in place, few thought advertising would take hold. But the FDA underestimated the wiliness of the pharmaceutical industry, which invented a new art form, finding ways to make their wares seem like joyous must-have treatments while often minimizing lackluster efficacy and risks. A 2023 study found that among top-selling drugs, those with the lowest levels of added benefit tended to spend more on advertising to patients than doctors. I worry that direct-to-consumer advertising can be used to drive demand for marginally effective drugs or for drugs with more affordable or more cost-effective alternatives, said the study's author, Michael DiStefano, a professor of clinical pharmacology at the University of Colorado. Indeed, more than 50% of what Medicare spent on drugs from 2016 through 2018 was for drugs that were advertised. Half of the 10 drugs that the federal government targeted for drug price negotiation this year are among the drugs with the largest direct-to-consumer ad spend. The government has, in recent years, tried to ensure that prescription drug advertising gives a more accurate and easily understood picture of benefits and harms, but the results have been disappointing. When the Trump administration tried to get policymakers to list the price of any treatment costing over $35 on TV ads, for example, the industry took it to federal court, saying the mandate violated drug makers' First Amendment rights. Big Pharma won. Again. Last November, the FDA issued requirements that ads give consumers a non-misleading net impression about the advertised drug. The agency stated that information had to be presented in a, quote, clear, conspicuous, and neutral manner. Ads must avoid, quote, audio and visual elements that might interfere with the consumer's understanding, and text information is presented in a way that is easy to read. But the language is disappointingly vague. What do neutral and non-misleading mean? Do the proscribed audiovisual elements include people hiking or dancing to upbeat music? How quickly or slowly can the chyrons listing adverse reactions scurry across your screen? There is no FDA police force to decide how the language should be interpreted. I asked the agency for an interview to get some clarity on the plans, but instead got a 3-page email that, well, left me worrying that the blizzard of drug ads is here to stay. It told me that ads are not vetted before airing unless the manufacturers voluntarily submit them because it is, quote, the drug maker's responsibility to make sure they comply. How do they catch ads that are not compliant? Often via consumer complaints or when an agency staff member sees a booth with misleading information at a conference, the email said. Yikes. The Federal Trade Commission, which oversees ads in other sectors, from banking to contact lenses, is more active in suing to halt those it considers deceptive or misleading. In recent years, it sued to prevent unsupported claims on stem cell treatments for arthritis and false or misleading information about some health insurance plans. But it has no jurisdiction over direct-to-consumer drug advertising, a commission spokesperson said. Common sense and the sort of truth in advertising standard we apply in other sectors should be a suitable first step. Take ads that promise patients with advanced cancers a chance to live longer. A more truthful ad might say that studies are equivocal or, as the widower of one patient drawn in by an ad wrote in an op-ed article, an outside chance for people with advanced lung cancer to live just a few months longer, and they're not likely to be hiking or hitting the beach during that time. Gerard Anderson, the professor of health policy at Johns Hopkins University School of Public Health, proposes that, at the very least, drug ads should be required to feature prominent warnings about risks, like those on cigarette packs. If you see it on TV or on social media, it's probably not as good as something else, he added, or at least it's more expensive. Remember that media ads for cigarettes were ubiquitous before they were banned by a congressional act, which took effect in 1971, because they were found to promote a dangerous product. Yes, it's a harder case to make with advertising for pharmaceuticals, some of which harm many people with their side effects and costs, but certainly can help some a great deal. Couldn't someone in politics make these endless drug ads disappear, as has occurred in nearly every other developed country? Companies prodding patients to ask your doctor for drugs that they may not need isn't just about truth in advertising or breaking government and personal budgets. It's an issue of public health. Amen to that. And next up, a little more about those negotiated drug prices. This from Reuters. U.S. will still pay at least twice as much after negotiating drug prices. The U.S. government's first ever negotiated prices for prescription drugs are still, on average, more than double, and in some cases, five times, what drug makers have agreed to in four other high-income countries, a Reuters review has found. The U.S. Medicare health plan, which covers more than 67 million people, recently unveiled new maximum prices for the first 10 high-cost medicines negotiated under the Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act. This is the first time Medicare has disclosed actual drug prices, which are largely hidden behind a complicated U.S. system of rebates and discounts. The lower prices will result in savings of $6 billion in 2026, the first year they take effect, Medicare said. A Reuters review of publicly available maximum prices set by other wealthy nations, Australia, Japan, Canada, and Sweden, show that they have negotiated far lower prices for the same drugs. In the U.S., we've always accepted that we are the country that overpays relative to the rest of the world, said Stacy Desitzina, professor of health policy at Nashville's Vanderbilt University. I guess we should just get used to it, huh? Puh, I think not. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And my guarantee to you is if you listen to this show for a year, you will easily know more than 99% of the population. And should for some chance this not be the case, I will gladly triple your money back. So, with paying so much more than other countries for drugs that are even largely manufactured here, are we getting our money's worth? This from MedPage Today. Nearly 2,000 pharmaceutical plants are overdue for FDA checks after COVID delays. Federal regulators responsible for the safety of the U.S. drug supply are still struggling to get back to where they were in 2019, before the COVID-19 pandemic upended factory inspections in the U.S. and across the world, the Associated Press has found. An Associated Press analysis of FDA data shows that agency staffers have not returned to roughly 2,000 pharmaceutical manufacturing firms to conduct surveillance inspections since before the pandemic, raising the risk of contamination and other issues in drugs used by millions of Americans. The firms that are overdue for safety and quality inspections represent about 42% of the 4,700 plants that are currently registered to produce drugs for the U.S. and previously underwent FDA review before May of 2019. The plants make hundreds of critical medicines, including antibiotics, blood thinners, and cancer therapies. Under FDA's own guidelines, factories that haven't been inspected in 5 or more years are considered a significant risk and are supposed to be prioritized for, quote, mandatory inspections. Most of the overdue plants are in the U.S., but more than 340 are in India and China, countries that together make up the largest source of drug ingredients used in low-cost U.S. prescriptions. Generic drug makers are under intense pressure to cut their costs, and some will do that by cutting quality, said David Ridley of Duke University, who studies the pharmaceutical industry. If they're not inspected, then we won't know about it until, in a few tragic cases, it's too late. Last year, for instance, tainted eye drops from an Indian factory led to an outbreak of antibiotic-resistant bacteria that sickened more than 80 Americans, killing 4 of them and blinding more than a dozen others. The plant never registered with the FDA. Prior to COVID-19, dozens of common medications made at FDA-regulated plants were recalled due to traces of cancer-causing contaminants. The FDA didn't open its first overseas outpost until 2008, after dozens of U.S. deaths were linked to a contaminated blood thinner imported from a Chinese plant that hadn't been inspected. But last year's inspection numbers were still down almost 40% from the pre-pandemic period, when the FDA averaged around 4,300 annual inspections. The FDA has offered no date for when the backlog of uninspected plants might be cleared. The agency's work has been hampered by a wave of staff departures, including longtime inspectors who have found new jobs that often allow them to work from home. The FDA halted all but the most, quote, mission-critical inspections in March of 2020. It gradually restarted prioritized inspections later that year, but regular international visits did not resume until 2022. The FDA struggles overseeing the global pharmaceutical supply have been documented by the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, which has flagged the area as high risk, has a high-risk issue every year since 2009. Beginning in the 1990s, drug makers began shifting manufacturing overseas, first to Puerto Rico and then to Asia in search of cheaper labor and materials. The FDA has largely been playing catch-up ever since. On a global basis, FDA has said only 6% of sites inspected last year had serious problems, but rates are higher in India, where 11% of plants were cited for violations, the most for any country. Nearly 90% of FDA's foreign inspections in fiscal year 2023 were announced in advance, according to FDA correspondence with Congress obtained, which Congress obtained via public records requests. The GAO and other government watchdogs have long raised concerns about the practice, which typically gives companies up to 12 weeks to correct or conceal potential problems. Even with advance warnings, the FDA has found egregious violations in overseas factories. When agency staffers visited Intas Pharmaceuticals plant in northwest India for the first time in nearly 3 years, they found what they called, quote, a cascade of failure. Among the violations, inspectors saw an employee pouring acetic acid in a trash bin to destroy company documents used for drug testing. Elsewhere, inspectors found plastic bags filled with torn and discarded documents related to quality control measures. This kind of behavior has been pointed out to the FDA time and time again by people like me for the last 10 years, said Dinesh Thakur, a former pharmaceutical industry executive who has become a whistleblower for the U.S. government. In 2013, his work led to a $500 million settlement with Indian drug maker Ranbaxy for falsifying generic drug data. If you do not prosecute people who do this kind of wrongdoing, it gives the implicit signal that the FDA will give companies a pass, Thakur said. FDA inspections in India have been accelerating, but 160 plants are overdue, including some which haven't been inspected since 2015, yet continue shipping pain pills, antibiotics, and other medications to the U.S., according to the AP's analysis. In China, political tensions have made inspections even more challenging. Just two full-time FDA inspectors are based in the country, where about 185 factories are overdue. Former FDA officials said the Chinese government has withheld visas from inspectors unless the U.S. reciprocates for Chinese nationals seeking to enter the U.S. FDA Commissioner Robert Califf has acknowledged his discomfort with the current situation. Even if we do periodic inspections, it's not the same as a society where you have more freedom of information, Califf told lawmakers at a hearing last year. I'm very concerned about it. The FDA could seemingly address its inspection backlog by hiring more investigators or assigning extra work to current staffers, but the agency is struggling to hold on to inspectors who can earn far more working for the companies they now regulate. On a call with FDA stakeholders in May, the FDA warned that our attrition rates and our inability to retain our staff would soon impact the agency's ability to oversee drugs and other medical supplies. The FDA currently has 225 vacancies on its inspection workforce, nearly four times as many as before COVID-19. FDA said it's exploring ways to make the jobs more attractive, including extra pay for experienced staffers and offering more flexible, comfortable travel arrangements. Testing for quality. A pilot program requested by the U.S. Department of Defense takes an alternative approach to monitoring the drug supply. The Pentagon is collaborating with a private laboratory to evaluate 40 prescription drugs critical to military personnel, testing them for contaminants, dosing, and other issues. Initial findings from a two-year program found serious flaws in about 10% of a subset of drugs tested, according to results shared with the AP. Laboratory testing of imported drugs has long been standard practice in Europe, where more than 70 private labs operate alongside government regulators. The testing approach has attracted interest from experts concerned that FDA's method, rooted in physical inspections and reviewing paperwork, may not be up to the task in uncovering manufacturing problems on the other side of the world. Kevin Shulman of Stanford University said one solution would be to incentivize U.S. pharmacy chains and drug distributors to only purchase drugs from high-quality manufacturers. Currently, U.S. companies decide which generic drugs to buy based on whichever company has the lowest price, Shulman said. Purchasers say, well, it's the FDA's job to worry about quality, not ours. Even as the FDA struggles to recover from COVID-19 and reinspect plants worldwide, Shulman sees a potential upside. Maybe this is a straw that breaks the camel's back, he said. That, in fact, we should just admit that one U.S. agency can't regulate the entire globe of manufacturing for this critically important market. Wow, maybe we could do better paying so much more than others around the world for the exact same drugs. Maybe U.S. capitalism is better at delivering exorbitant profits than a good product at a fair price. Okay, well, that ends our regular news coverage. Now for our next feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 34 bonus articles this week, so let's get to it. Number one, Latin American nations once lagged on abortion rights. Now some present role models for the United States. This is just a sad commentary on the fact that the U.S. used to be a leader in abortion rights, but is now lagging in the Americas. Bonus article two, states with strictest abortion laws offer the least support for women and families. So this is new research once again confirming that those that can least do with strict abortion laws are the ones that get the least support. Yikes. Bonus article three, New Mexico starts building an abortion clinic to serve neighboring states and train medical students. So here we see the bifurcation, the split between red and blue states, those that are abortion friendly and abortion restrictive. And New Mexico is now trying to help serve neighboring states who don't have access to reproductive health care and train medical students who can't be trained in the state that they're actually supposed to be trained in. Bonus article four, Judge blocks Ohio from enforcing laws restricting medication abortions. So this is just another of the rollout or rollback of Ohio anti-abortion laws that were basically made illegal by the constitutional amendment passed by the people. But of course, it takes a while for the courts to strike down those laws based on the new constitutional amendment. Bonus Article 5. Upending a long-standing paradigm, cardiologists embrace zip codes, not race, to predict heart disease, sharpening focus of heart disease as a social determinant. So for many years, just using race as a risk factor, as if race were a biological reality, which it's not, it's a biological fiction. We just racialize populations. That's a social construct. It's not a biological construct. But there are social constructs, social determinants. And in fact, your zip code is a better predictor of heart risk than, in fact, race as a proxy for other factors. Bonus Article 6. Inside a bruising battle to purge race from a kidney disease calculator. So this is a good kind of history and overview of this long battle. I've reported on this before, but it's another example where over generations, black folks had race used when they were assessing for kidney disease, and this actually led to under-treatment for people when, in fact, they had as much risk as white folks. Bonus Article 7. Errors in Deloitte-run Medicaid systems can cost millions and take years to fix. So much for the private sector doing so much of a better job. This billion-dollar industry of running Medicaid systems has not been met well, and these systems are throwing people off Medicaid that are in fact eligible. Bonus Article 8. When facing unaffordable and problematic medical bills, self-advocacy often pays off, but leaves a disproportionate burden of the broken system on those most vulnerable. So if you do challenge a problematic medical bill, you can often get some relief. But the people that do that are actually those that are a little bit less likely to actually require or need that relief. So it just shifts the burden on those that are most vulnerable. Bonus Article 9. Farmers fear nursing homes because they could lose their family farms. So this is an unusual thing based on the structures of family farms, is that they have a lot of capital in their land that has been held for generations. But like other Americans, if you get moved into a nursing home, you have to spend down basically all your assets, and that could include the family farm. So you could lose generations of wealth by one person sick and needing a nursing home. Bonus Article 10. Farmers are relying on plastic more than ever, but the environmental toll is growing. So this growth in plastic use in farming is growing quickly. And people are putting, you know, single-use plastic over millions of acres. And this is not a good idea. You know, you might think it's odd seeing a plastic bag from a grocery store blowing around out in the environment, but we're doing this in mass across the world using plastic in agriculture. Bonus Article 11. The world is pumping out 57 million tons of plastic pollution a year, and much of the world doesn't have solid waste systems to deal with it. So while in the global north we might be actually using more plastic pollution, we do have the ability to, for instance, just bury it in the ground. May not be a perfect solution, but it's better than just having it floating around in rivers or going, you know, laying out on the land. So it's another example of where the entire world get together and we have to come up with better solid waste systems to deal with plastic. Of course, reducing production and use would be the primary solution. Bonus Article 12. In Louisiana, environmental justice advocates ponder next steps after a federal judge bars EPA civil rights probe into environmental racism. So the fight continues, but it was a big setback when the federal judge basically said environmental racism isn't a thing. You can't use civil rights in these EPA battles. Bonus Article 13. 3M Corteva Chemours hit with class action over forever chemicals in carpet. So here's another legal action, class action suit. And if you have a carpet, say, in your home that was has been there since from 2020 or earlier, is virtually 100% that it has PFAS in it and that you are being exposed. And of course, they're trying to claw back some of the cost of the damage that that's producing to our health. Bonus Article 14. States push EPA to label more PFAS as toxic air pollutants. So this is something I've reported on before too, that PFAS is actually aerosolized. It blows around the world with the rain and such, and literally rains down on us. But because the EPA doesn't classify it as an air pollutant, it's not regulated. Another part of public health is you have to look at it or measure it or assess it before you can do anything about it. Defining the problem is half of the solution. Bonus Article 15. More New York Fire Department responders have died from 9/11 related illnesses than the attack itself. So almost 400 New York Fire folks, responders, died in the 9/11 acutely on that day, but more than that number, nearly 400 people have died from 9/11 related illnesses since then. And this is just another example of when you're looking at public health, we tend to look at what's the most visible, but there's an aftermath. In this case, a lot of the toxic stuff that was, whether it's dust or chemicals, from the site burning, for instance, has created a lot of health problems that roll out over years and years following and get less attention. Bonus Article 16. New global guidance aims to curb antibiotic pollution from its manufacturing. So this is one I hadn't heard of in antimicrobial resistance, is that when you're actually manufacturing antibiotics around those manufacturing plants, there's a lot of antibiotic pollution. And this is a perfect way to generate antibiotic-resistant microbes. One more front to fight on. Bonus Article 17. Breast cancer rises rapidly among Asian American and Pacific Islander women. So they aren't entirely why this is happening, but in the last 10 or 15 years or so, we've seen rapid rises in breast cancer. Bonus Article 18. Mobile phones are not linked to brain cancer, according to a major review of 28 years of research. A little bit of good news. Bonus Article 19, high blood pressure, a concern for adolescents and young adults in the U.S. So we're seeing that as many health problems, chronic diseases move earlier and earlier in populations. This is not a good sign for the future health of America. But high blood pressure is something we need to be looking at for adolescents and young adults as well. Bonus Article 20. Cruciferous vegetables like cabbage, broccoli, and kale, for instance, add lowering blood pressure to their powerful anti-cancer effects. So I think one of the most underrated anti-cancer things and nutrition things and vegetable things is cruciferous vegetables, which are those from the cabbage family, like cabbage, broccoli, kale, radishes, bok choy, and the like. These are very powerful anti-cancer. I personally, in my own diet, try to get them pretty much every day if I can, and get multiple servings when you can. But like many vegetables, the cruciferous vegetables also can lower blood pressure. Bonus Article 21. Community fridges are helping neighbors nourish one another. This is a good example of neighbors helping each other in community efforts. So by having you might have seen little mini pantries around, like the little libraries, but community fridges being refrigerated, you can store and distribute a whole bunch of different types of food. So it allows people to cook for, other people in their community. It reduces food waste and decreases food insecurity. Bonus Article 22. Doing lunges while brushing your teeth and other ways to stack healthy habits with habit pairing. So this idea of habit pairing, you link up a new habit with an old habit that you already have, like in this instance, brushing your teeth and doing lunges. If there's something that you regularly do, you can attach another habit to it, and it's a good way to build healthy habits. Bonus Article 23, Oregon's measles outbreak highlights state's high vaccine exemption rate. So when you get to infectious diseases, this is something that has to take a communal response. You can't just do it doing lunges while brushing your teeth or whatever individual kind of health behaviors we can do. But because Oregon has high vaccine exemption rates, you get pockets of where vaccination rates fall below the 95% coverage that you need to protect a community from measles spread throughout. Bonus Article 24. Do kids need to get sick to build their immune system? Basically, not really. This is particularly true with viruses. There's really no advantage to getting sick with viruses as opposed to, say, a vaccine, which is a way of getting immunity without getting sick. Now, it's a little more true with bacteria because, like, the hygiene hypothesis is that, you know, you don't want to overclean and wipe out because we have a microbiome and a biome in our home and our environment. So, you know, living and working outside and gardening and having pets and that type of thing can actually expose us to bacteria that can actually give us a more biodiversity in our microbiome and actually allow us to be healthier. But that's not necessarily getting sick. That's just being exposed to a wide variety of things in our environment. Bonus Article 25. Kids are headed back to school. Many aren't breathing clean air. So this is a frontier in public health, is getting clean air, indoor clean air. And of course, it's a little bit complicated because our outdoor air isn't necessarily as clean either. So you have to balance bringing in outside air with producing clean air inside. Bonus Article 26. An even more contagious COVID strain is just getting started. So COVID is still proving to be a wily virus. And this is why we're seeing multiple surges throughout the year, not just in the winter, like, you know, flu season, you know, cold and flu season, is because these strains are becoming new and they'll last for a few months and a new one will come over a few months. So by the time you go from winter to winter, you've gone through several cycles of that. And of course, it makes it more difficult to keep up with vaccines as well. Bonus Article 27, five burning questions about Missouri's mysterious H5 bird flu case. So in case you haven't heard about this, this is the case where somebody got bird flu and they don't have any evidence of that coming from an animal. So just another in the story, this narrative of bird flu, and will it or will it not become transmissible between humans? Bonus Article 28, presidential debate moderators should ask these questions about mental health policy. Good luck with that. I think that's a good idea. Mental health policy is an important thing. And this article is a very good review article about mental health policy, the state of it in this country. But I doubt if we're going to get down to that kind of nitty gritty. Bonus Article 29. Methadone could cut fentanyl deaths in half or lead to more addiction. Or lead more into addiction. So this is just an example, basically, of, methadone's a very powerful drug, and typically it's methadone clinics that people get. And as they've loosened that up somewhat, they haven't seen a lot of misuse of methadone, but they're talking about going even further and getting methadone out. And some people are concerned because methadone is a powerful drug that it may lead to some unintended negative side effects. Bonus Article 30, speaking of unintended side effects, assessing tardive dyskinesia risk, which is uncontrolled movements in patients taking any dopamine blocker. So if you're taking a dopamine blocker, you have a definite risk over time of developing the TD, tardive dyskinesia, which is uncontrolled movements, not a good side effect. Once you get that, it doesn't go away. Bonus Article 31, FDA ups required photo ID age to 30 for smokers buying tobacco products. So it used to be 27. They're supposed to be carded if the person looks 27 or older. Now it's 30 or older. And if anybody, yourself or somebody you care about, is interested in quitting smoking, you can call 1-800-QUIT-NOW for free help. Bonus Article 32, letting funding for All of Us research program lapse will cost the U.S. far more than it saves. Investing in preventive medicine and precision medicine now will save lives and billions of dollars. So I reported on this quite a while back. This is a huge program that is really supposed to represent all of us, which much research does not. And it could be used for preventive medicine and what is called precision medicine, which by doing a lot of genetic analysis, they can do very precise analyses of what kind of drugs and treatments would work for one person versus another. Most developed countries have large databases of their like national health programs, which we don't have, so they already have this kind of de facto. But if they don't get the funding that renewed, we'll probably lose half the benefit of this research program. Bonus Article 33 related to that. Boom, now bust. Budget cuts and layoffs take hold in public health. So there was a boom of public health funding that happened with the COVID pandemic, but that is all running out and layoffs are taking hold. So you can imagine trying to run a project or a business and say every few years you have to cut down to half of that, say every 4 or 5 years, what that would mean for the long-term effectiveness. This is public health's story of life from year to year and decade to decade. And last but not least, bonus article 34, clinicians star in off-Broadway musical about antimicrobial resistance. Yes, you've heard it here. So the arts is another way of promoting public health. And I would like to say that if in doubt, produce an off-Broadway musical. You can read this and any other article I've reported in this episode or previous episodes by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out.